Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When a woman dyes her skin with henna, the color is visible for just a couple of weeks before it begins to fade. But in cultures that use henna to tell stories, garner blessings, and ward off misfortune, the symbolism contained within a design can have a lasting effect. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Nomi Eve's latest novel tells the story of a Jewish girl in Yemen in the 1920s, at risk of removal from her family and placement with a Muslim foster family in the event she is orphaned before marriage. Young Adela lives in fear of being taken from her family, but she also hopes to marry for love rather than in an arrangement designed only for the sake of keeping her out of the custody of a man known as the Confiscator. Her hopes are raised by the arrival of some relatives from out of town who open her eyes to the possibilities of love and of a kind of empowerment she could scarcely have dreamed of before. Novelist Nomi Eve is the author of The Family Orchard and Henna House, the book we're talking about today, which has recently been published in paperback. Henna House is the book selection for this year's Jewish Federation of Greater Dallas Community Read event, which takes place this evening at 7 at the Aaron Family JCC in Dallas. Nomi Eve, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I love it when a book takes me into a world that I just had not experienced before. How were you drawn to Yemen in the 1920s?
Well, it's very far from where I live in Philadelphia. but I was drawn to Yemen, specifically to the Kingdom of North Yemen in the 1920s through a family connection. I have a beloved aunt who was Yemenite, a Yemenite Jew who came to Israel in 1950 on Operation Magic Carpet. And it was through many visits with her in her kitchen, eating her delicious food and listening to her wonderful stories that I fell in love with this time and place and decided I had to write a book about it.
Operation Magic Carpet was this initiative by the Israeli government to bring Yemenite Jews who were really threatened living in their homeland and needed a place to go.
Yeah, it was the first of these really massive, large-scale secret operations to bring whole communities to Israel. And the Yemenite Jews walked down. They left their homes, walked down through the mountains, surviving perilous journeys. And they were secreted away on planes chartered by the young Israeli government and flown to Israel.
After reading the book, I got really curious about this, and I went online and did some research, and there are these really interesting pictures of people in very traditional dress, like packed into a modern, in 1950, modern airplane for this trip.
Oh, it's an incredible story. I mean, the Jews from the Kingdom of North Yemen lived very they lived cut off from the modern world. People reading my book say that it's like reading about people in biblical days. And here they were on airplanes. And when they first saw the airplanes, they thought they were metal birds. And they were afraid they would fall from the sky.
Wow. Now, what I sensed reading this book was a kind of wary acceptance in the 20s between neighboring Muslims and Jews in Adela's small town. The government poses a threat, but people from the communities do business together. They know each other. They generally coexist. They're not friends.
One of my favorite stories that I learned when researching this book and then used in my book is how women actually from the different communities, the Jewish community and the Muslim communities, actually shared and exchanged henna images and patterns. And they had a special term for this. Using the henna image of the other community, if you're Jewish, using a Muslim image, if you're Muslim, using a Jewish image, was called sharing the stranger magic of your sisters. And it was considered especially lucky. And I just loved this. I loved learning that, you know, we can look at each other as magical, not necessarily as other.
I love even the sort of wink and a nod idea, like, I don't believe your ridiculous mythology, but if it might actually work, then I'll give it a try.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's probably safe to say that all children fear the loss of their parents, right? That's kind of like an inherent fear in childhood. But this is not theoretical for Adela.
No. There was an ancient law, part of a series of laws called the Dhimmi laws, which governed how a Muslim majority government was supposed to act towards its minority communities. And this law called the Orphans Decree was one of these ancient Dhimmi laws. And a new imam came to power in 1918 in the Kingdom of North Yemen, and he decided to bring back the Orphans Decree. And the Orphans Decree stated that any Jewish child who lost their father was to be confiscated, that was the word they used, by the Muslim government, adopted by a Muslim family and converted to Islam. And this was a terrifying reality for the Jews of North Yemen.
What's so fascinating about this is that it sounds like the kind of thing that could be seen and understood in very different ways by the different communities. Like, you can imagine that the Muslims who put this in place were like, well, this is a benevolent act. Obviously, for the Jews that were affected by this, this felt very much like they were being robbed of their children, and these children were being deprived of their heritage.
Absolutely. I mean, what I learned is that the Orphans Decree was a really, really, really misguided attempt at social welfare. The thinking by the Muslim government was that these children, if their fathers died, would have nobody to care for them. So the government needed to take the children and care for them. And I think it's important to see it in that way. Of course, the Jews didn't experience it in that way, especially when there was a surviving mother, you know, who had her children taken away. But you're right. This was seen in very different ways by the different communities.
And I think American readers will recognize parallels to the education programs put in place for Native Americans, where they were, you know, sent off to these, you know, Christian boarding schools. Some people thought that they were doing the right thing, and yet families were really destroyed by these actions.
Absolutely. I think that's really interesting to see it that way, too, because nothing that we learn about in history happens in isolation, and we can see recurrences and patterns in different cultures and different times.
Adela has this really interesting relationship to her mother, who seems incapable of showing any real affection to her family. There are clues that she does care, but she's very troubled, and in ways that are not just comical. She can be very cruel, and she's not especially concerned about her daughter's happiness in trying to find someone to marry her off to protect her from confiscation.
Adela's mother is a real piece of work. She is not an easy character. I tell people that, first of all, everything Adela's mother does for Adela, even though it seems really harsh and difficult, she really is trying to do what's best for her daughter in a harsh and unforgiving world. Now, having said that, the way I see Adela's mother is that if I had to take care of my family in the circumstances that Adela's mother has to take care of her family, I might not be the happiest mom around either. You know, when I make dinner for my family, I go to the grocery store and I buy really beautiful food and I come home and I prepare it and it's all easy and I cook it in my oven and I have my dishwasher and I clean up, you know, no problem. But for Adela's mother, just to put bread on her family's table three times a day, she not only has to bake the bread herself, but she has to grind the wheat to bake the bread. And my female characters are always out by the grinding stones, grinding wheat. And this is a woman really ground down by life.
Yeah, it occurred to me, I found myself not really liking her, but sympathizing with her, because I realized that as she's saying to her daughter, just marry whoever I find for you and shut up about it because this is your lot in life, that's probably exactly what happened to her.
Absolutely. And I won't give any spoilers away.
Right. And neither will I.
But I will say that if people go back and look and see who it is that Adela's mother first wants Adela to marry, let's just say, like, the woman, like, she knows what she's talking about.
So Adela does find this one place where she can feel fully at home, which ironically is a secret to almost everybody she knows.
Yes, Adela has a cave. And I really think every little girl needs a cave. And I think a lot of us had our own caves, even if they were little corners in our backyard somewhere. Adela has this place that she can go to and feel free. And it's a really important place in the book. And I didn't know it was going to appear. You know, there are things as writers that we do that we know are going to happen and other things that just like appear. And the cave just appeared one day and became a really important part of the book.
The writing here is so rich in sensory detail. I have not been to North Yemen, the kingdom of what was once the kingdom of North Yemen, but I felt like I could picture the roads and the streets and the space between houses and the lemon grove. Sometimes it almost feels like it was just there so that we could immerse ourselves in the situation. There are passages that aren't necessarily driving the plot, but they put us there.
I'm a reader who loves feeling like you just described. I love feeling pulled into the world of a book. And I know as a writer that if you write with your senses, if I tell you what a place smells like and feels like and tastes like, then you're going to have a sensory experience of the place. So I do that very intentionally. I do it in order to give a real immersive sense of time and place.
I liked the character of the dime mistress, who is this woman who is supposed to be kind of a tragic figure, right, because she never married. And she has a really realistic understanding of the pros and cons of that fact in her life.
I love the dime mistress. She was a character that I didn't know was going to appear until she did. And she appears in order to give Adela safe passage to her cave, because Adela needs a way to get to the cave without being seen. And the dime mistress grew up in a day before the Orphan's Decree, before 1918. So she was able to survive, let's just say, what was then known as spinsterhood without being confiscated. And she really provides Adela with an alternate vision and role model of how to be a woman in this society. And I love everything about her, and I'm glad she showed up.
We essentially meet Adela when she's a little girl, and yet you let us know from the very first page of the book that she is an old woman with grandchildren reflecting back on her life. We don't know anything about the circumstances and how she gets from here to there. Talk about how you made that decision and why you felt it was important to let us know that the woman that we meet is looking back on a long life.
Particularly partial as a reader to elegies, to love songs, to people we loved and lost a lifetime ago. And I wanted to infuse this narrative with that sense of love and longing that can only be given through perspective. So it was very important to me that this isn't just a story of what happened to this girl, this young woman, but it's also a story of how she understands this story in terms of her entire life experience. So I really needed to give it that distance, that long view.
How did you get interested in the use of henna? It wasn't something that I was aware was even part of any aspect of Jewish tradition.
When I was doing my research into Yemenite Jewish history and culture, and I read about henna, the henna traditions, I was absolutely flabbergasted. Like most, like you, I had no idea that Jews did henna. I'm Jewish, but I'm Ashkenazi, which means my family comes from Eastern Europe, not from the Arab world. And I didn't know Jews did henna. So I was really, really interested. And soon I learned that all the Jews of the Arab world have their own precious henna life cycle rituals. So it just blew me away, and I needed to know more. I was particularly interested in how henna is a kind of rudimentary literacy, a way for women to pass down knowledge and leave a mark in a time and place when they're often denied an education.
We're speaking this hour with novelist Nomi Eve about her novel Henna House, which is out now in paperback. She's in town for the Jewish Federation of Greater Dallas Community Read event at 7 this evening at the Aaron Family JCC in Dallas. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Nomi Eve, author of The Family Orchard and now Henna House. That book is out now in paperback. She's in town for the Jewish Federation of Greater Dallas Community Read event, which takes place this evening at 7 at the Aaron Family JCC in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think at kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Adela does not have formal education. She hasn't gone to school. And what I like about the book is that you don't sort of make her precocious, and she's not longing like you would see in some books for an education. She doesn't even really think of this as something that women can have until the arrival of a really remarkable aunt and cousin who kind of open her eyes to the possibilities that she can know more and have this kind of empowerment, whether it's formal or informal, from learning things.
Yeah. You know, so many books that I love are not about the day everything stayed the same in somebody's life. They're about the day everything changed. And so in writing this book, I knew I wanted it to be about the day life changes for a girl named Adela Damari. And one of the way it changes for her is through the arrival of her aunt Rachel and her cousin Hani, who come with them bearing not only the gifts of henna, they teach her how to do henna, but also the gifts of literacy, the sisterhood magic of words and letters.
Hani is like that neighbor or that older cousin that all of us had, just a little bit older, a little bit cooler, a little bit more streetwise. She may or may not be a good or bad influence, but Adela is very much under her spell from the beginning.
Yeah, Adela is completely smitten by her. And Hani has a lot to offer. But we know from pretty early on that she's a real double-edged sword. As wonderful as she is, she also feels a little dangerous.
Her mother, Rachel, is bar none, probably everyone's favorite character, right? She's this kind of mystical figure. She's got great gifts as a healer. She has studied medicine in a somewhat formal way, but also in traditional medicine. And she has amazing gifts as a henna artist. So amazing that she has Jewish women coming to her for designs, and she has Muslim women, and they don't really care. They just want her henna on them.
Yeah. Aunt Rachel is, I feel so lucky and blessed in my life because I have grown up with wonderful aunts, whether, the aunts I'm related to, aunts who are friends of my mother's. And I think that relationship between a younger girl and an older woman who is like their mother but not their mother is such an important relationship. And I wanted Aunt Rachel to be that character for Adela, to be someone who can open up her eyes in a really special way.
And stand up to Adela's mother.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes, absolutely.
We don't really know at first, and we learn later, why Adela's mother just simply cannot stand Aunt Rachel, and she sort of views her as just inappropriate and to be held at arm's length. And it's hard to understand that. And of course, this is something that Adela wrestles with, too. Like, why can't my mother just love Aunt Rachel like I do?
Well, there are a whole bunch of reasons. But one that I think is particularly interesting is that in this time and place, when women took the place of what we would say is traditional doctors, because there were no doctors. If a henna artist, decorated a laboring mother's skin or a new bride's skin, and then something bad happened to that bride or that mother, the henna artist could be blamed. And one of the reasons why Adela's mother wants Adela to stay away from Aunt Rachel is Adela's mother is really afraid that Aunt Rachel will be blamed for something and that somehow this taint will also rub off on her daughter.
And yet Rachel herself doesn't absolutely believe that henna is magic.
No. Rachel is, she knows that it's just crushed up leaves.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone to Lydia in Dallas. Hey, Lydia.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question for your guest, and I really hope that she can answer it. I would like to ask her, how were the Jews in Yemen threatened, and if she has any idea of, in order for those Jews from Yemen to move to Israel, the Israeli government, how many houses belonging to innocent Palestinian civilians they've destroyed, and how many civilian Palestinians they've killed?
Thank you so much for your call, Lydia. I don't know if you've looked into that history, that portion of the history at all in researching what is a novel in this case. So we know that there are still a lot of difficult feelings between these two communities. You're writing about a time before real violence had begun to be kind of an everyday event.
You know, this is certainly a very complicated subject, and it is outside of the purview of the novel that I wrote.
Okay. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. The story was a reminder for me of how within the last century, and even today in the developing world, lack of access to modern health care was made life extremely perilous. I'm guessing that Adela's father has tuberculosis or something like it. Nobody can really tell how long he's going to die, but for years, it's evident that he will not live a full life.
Yeah, as a historical novelist, one of the things that strikes me as I do my research is, you know, every day I'm so grateful that we live when we live, because even in the early 20th century, there were so many people, even today, living without access to good health care. And Adela's father has this horrible cough, and we know he's going to die from it one day. And, you know, it's a cough that probably could have been cured by antibiotics, but they didn't have antibiotics. So I'm very, very grateful that we live when we live, and I'm very conscious that people's lives and their stories were shaped simply by, you know, their access or lack of access to modern medicine.
Adela falls in love very early, earlier than most people would say they truly fell in love with someone. And I wonder if you talk about the decision to make her have what seemed like very adult feelings when she is just 8 or 9 years old.
Well, once the Orphans Decree was brought back in 1918 in the Kingdom of North Yemen, the Jews of North Yemen really realized that they had an ingenious way of protecting their children from confiscation. And this was to engage and marry their children as children, because married children were not taken. So that's why Adela is engaged to be married at, you know, when she's a baby, basically. And she will be married when she's 11 or 12 to protect her from confiscation. Now, our modern sensibilities are completely horrified by this, you know, the thought of an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old being married. But in that day, that's what the Jews could do to protect their children. Now, Adela falls hard and fast for her cousin Asaf, to whom she will be engaged in order to protect them both for confiscation. And, you know, there is a scene in the book in which it's a little dicey. We have children, you know, sort of playing around and touching each other in a way that would seem to our modern eyes completely inappropriate. But I give Adela the feelings I give her, and I give her those experiences in order to give her some control over her own sexuality, her own emotional life, so that she's not just a character to whom things will happen, but she's a girl who can make things happen for herself.
And she's also living in a culture where, you know, unmarried at 15, she's begun to be perceived as an old maid.
Absolutely. And not only perceived as an old maid, but in danger of confiscation.
Mm-hmm. Talk about your research process and how you had the sense, especially when you're working in a place that, time has passed. And so it's not even like you could take a trip there and understand exactly what you're dealing with. What does it take for you to feel like you are steeped enough in a culture that is not your own to tell stories from a perspective within it?
It's a real process. I love doing research. For me, doing research is like eating candy. And I start with first-person narratives. I don't start with history books because I'm looking for sensory information. I want to know what the air smells like and what the food tastes like. So I start with first-person narratives of people who left their homes in the early 20th century and traveled to the Kingdom of North Yemen. In particular, there was a woman named Freya Stark, a British woman adventuress who traveled all over the Arab world and wrote incredible books about her travels. And with her, I climbed up on donkeys and I walked through markets and really got my feet on the ground. Then I read history books because I do want to get my facts straight. I read a lot of folk tales. I love folktales. I feel like they contain the concentrated essence of a culture. Then I surround my computer with cookbooks because my characters are always eating and cooking. I use museum catalogs because in museum catalogs, you can see the clothing people wore, their household objects. And then, you know, at a certain point, you just have to start making up a world on your own terms.
Hmm. There's a woman like Freya Stark that Adela meets when she hits the big city.
You got it. You of all the people I've spoken to, you're the first person to make that connection.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
She's dazzled by the idea that there is a place where girls go every single day and learn.
Yes. Yes, there's a British teacher in Aden. Adela starts the book in the Kingdom of North Yemen, but then her family travels down to Aden, which is a British protectorate. So it's governed by the British crown, and there are all sorts of British people there. And one of the people she meets is this teacher, this British woman, who teaches in a school for girls. And that place is absolutely magical for Adela.
So I have to ask you, there is... At various points in the book, this is discussed, and then there's a plot element where secret messages are hidden in henna. Is that something people really did?
Yeah, I love the secret code. So in my research, I read a folktale. Now, just like today, the Kingdom of North Yemen was a politically troubled place, and the imam was always the subject of fierce assassination plots. And I read a folktale in which a young man was part of one of these assassination plots, and he was also engaged to be married. And on his wedding night, he found instructions on how to assassinate the imam hidden, encoded in his bride's henna. And that folktale does not end well for the bride and groom. But it was from that folktale that I got the idea of using henna to hide or encode language. And if you ask an Indian henna artist today, she'll often tell you that she's asked to hide a bride's name in the bride's henna, and that on the wedding night, the groom has to find the bride's name before they can consummate the wedding.
Wow. So you want to make it challenging, but not too challenging.
Exactly.
Do you have things around when you're writing about a particular place that make you think of it? You put up pictures or...
Yes. Well, first of all, I am not a neat writer. So my desk will be filled with all the books that I'm using for my research, you know, just piled up everywhere. Writing this book, I was just particularly inspired by historic photographs of hennaed hands, which are really rare and hard to get a hold of. So those photographs were very important to me in my writing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Karen in Dallas. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you with... I'm sorry.
Oh, my goodness. Beautiful.
Karen, are you with us?
Yes.
All right. Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Karen.
Hi, Karen. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Sure. I'd like to know, what really happened to Mr. Musa? Did Hannah have anything to do with his death?
I love your question. Okay.
Tell us who Mr. Musa is and
yes,
then go from
yes.
there.
Yes, and this isn't really a spoiler because it's a little, very little thing. I love your question. Mr. Musa is one of the men that Adela is engaged to at a certain point in the novel.
He's horrible.
And he's just awful. We do not want Adela to marry Mr. Musa. And her cousin Hani, Adela's cousin Hani, sort of intimates to Adela, you know, Adela, don't worry, you're not going to marry this man. And Adela is wondering, well, how does Hani know? How does Hani know? And ultimately, Mr. Musa meets a bad end and Adela is released from that engagement. Now, I meet with tons of book clubs. I love meeting with book clubs. And my book clubs always ask me this question. They say, did Hani have something to do with Mr. Musa's death? And this is what I always say to people who ask me this question. So this is what I'll say to you. I take a survey and I say, what do you think? Do you think that Hani had a hand in Mr. Musa's death? And people always say, oh, yes, we think that she did, that somehow she, you know, helped off Mr. Musa. And then I tell the group, just like I'll tell you, that I really have no idea if Hani had a hand in Mr. Musa's death, because I make people up and then they walk around and they do things and they don't always tell me what they're up to.
There are actually a number of small things that are left unresolved. And I sort of like those, even though, you know, I'm dying to, you know, sit you down and give you a list of things I'd like you to answer for me. I like the idea, just because there's so many things in real life that we think someday I'll figure this out, and it never happens.
Absolutely. Real life is like that. We don't know all the answers. And I think that if you can make a story live on in your readers' minds, make them wonder about things, then there's a certain strength to that.
So you mentioned you've met with a lot of book clubs. You set a goal for yourself. Am I right about this? To, in either digital or real life form, sit down with 100 book clubs?
Yes. When my novel was first published in hardback last August, I gave myself a goal of meeting with 100 book clubs. And I thought that if I were lucky, I would do 50 for my hardback and then 50 for my paperback over the course of 2 years. But it really took off. And I met with 100 book clubs in 6 months last year. And I'm still meeting with book clubs. I'm now up to 145. And of those first 100, I did 70 in person and I did 30 by Skype. And now I'm only doing Skype and I just love it. I love chatting with book clubs.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. My guest is novelist Nomi Eve. Her newest book is called Henna House. It's out now in paperback. She's in town for the Jewish Federation of Greater Dallas Community Read event that happens at 7 this evening at the Aaron Family JCC in Dallas. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Nomi Eve. Her novels include The Family Orchard and Henna House, which has just been published in paperback. She's in town for the Jewish Federation of Greater Dallas Community Read event this evening at 7 at the Aaron Family JCC in Dallas. You can join our conversation here by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Nomi, I'm going to ask you your opinion of book clubs that do not require people to read the book. How do you feel about those?
Well, first let me say that I love book clubs, and I consider myself a bit of an anthropologist of book clubs at this point.
Yeah.
Because I have visited a lot. Book clubs are not just one thing. Book clubs are not just about reading the book. Book clubs are about women. Yes, sorry, fellas, but 99% of all book clubs are women. Book clubs are a woman's gathering ritual of our modern times. They are the way that women gather together to talk about their lives, to share stories, to laugh together on a regular basis. So I have no problem with book clubs in which, you know, people don't have to read the book, because that's not what it's only about.
But when it's your book?
Well, when it's my book, they always either read it or pretend to have read it. You know, if you're going to invite the author, then it's a very good thing to read the book.
Yeah. Are you surprised at the things that people are confused by, or the things that people leapt to conclusions that you think that was not in my mind when I was writing this?
Not really. You know, I do get questions every now and then that I didn't expect or that sort of come out of left field. But for the most part, readers are pretty much on the same wavelength with where I was when I was writing it and ask the kind of questions that I get.
So Adela has this sort of disagreement with her Aunt Rahel about whether it's appropriate for the henna designs to be copied into a paper book. And Adela has become so obsessed with this, she actually makes her own book, and she makes one for Hani so that they can have access to this wonderful technology. Her aunt says that's not what this is for. And it made me think a little bit about the difference between stories we tell in person, stories we tell in words, in speech, and those that we write down, and whether they're fundamentally two different things.
I love that you said that. I have like 7 or 8 stories that I call my spoken stories that I have tried for 20 years to write down.
Really?
20 years. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I can't do it. And I can tell these stories in a way that I will have you in the palm of my hand.
Are there any that fit into the next couple of minutes? Or are they all long?
They're all longer.
Okay. I won't put you on the spot.
But I'll come back and tell them to you one day.
All right.
And they're different animals. Yes, I do believe that there are stories, just like Aunt Rahel believes there's henna, that are living creatures almost that can't be trapped on a page.
Hmm. Are you from a storytelling family?
I am. My father researched our family history going back to King David.
And wow.
So I grew up with those stories, and I'm not exaggerating. So I grew up with—
No pressure there.
Right. So I grew up with stories of, you know, the Middle Ages and incredible stories that my father researched and collected. My father's mother, my grandmother, my Israeli grandmother, she was a mistress of the spoken story. And you know, you would be sitting with her having dinner, and all of a sudden she would tell you something astonishing. She was an incredible storyteller, and I really feel like every story she gave me was a gift.
It's always amazing when you've known someone for a very long time and you treasure their stories, but you've heard them all, you know, a dozen times, and then a new one emerges and you think, where did that come from? That was lying there all this time.
Yeah, and you're just hungry for it.
Yeah. And then there are questions, I would think, for a novelist that are really interesting about secrets that people keep. You know, Adela's mother has a secret. She has her own secrets. And they're such interesting things because on the one hand, we really want to keep them secret. And on the other hand, there's no greater relief than having them known.
Yeah. I think that many storytellers are people born with those secrets on our tongues, passed down to us, things in a family that weren't supposed to be said, and that pressure, between that tension between I have to keep it quiet and I have to say it is what turns us into writers.
Did you know you were a writer when you were a child?
No, I knew I was a reader. Hmm. I was always that kid with a book in my hand. But it wasn't until I went to college. I went to Penn State, and I took a writing workshop with a novelist, short story writer named Charlotte Holmes. And I knew then and there that writing was simultaneously the hardest thing that I could do and the most rewarding. And there was no looking back for me.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, most book clubs are made up of women. Of course, that's, you know, a general statement. But if you look at figures from publishers, most readers of fiction are women. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I have no idea. Boy, if I knew the answer to that question. I don't know if it's just how we shape our own lives in our own imagination somehow matches the way novels are written, or if women are just hungrier for narrative. I really have no idea.
I was thinking about the fact that although Certainly. I'll read just about anything that is, you know, worth reading. And I'll read stories that are very much about men. But I am more drawn to stories about women. And maybe it's that factor that we look to see some aspect of ourselves in what we read.
Yeah, absolutely. Though I must say, I'm a really eclectic reader, and I'm just as likely to read zombie books as I am to read literary fiction. So I hope I'm not looking for that aspect when I read zombie books.
Did you come to a point where you were like, I'm okay with this. I'm okay with reading good stuff and bad stuff and everything in between? Or was this like a secret thing for a while?
No. I grew up reading everything. And I mean, I remember as a kid being so excited to read, you know, anything, comic books, superhero stuff, the new Robert Ludlum, whatever it was. And I never stopped being that way. I just love stories, all kinds, thrillers, historical fiction, literary novels, memoirs, you know, whatever it is. I've always accepted that about myself without any shame.
So most, I guess, Jews of Yemenite heritage live in Israel now. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
How well have they assimilated?
The story of the Yemenite Jewish experience in Israel is a complicated one. When the Yemenites first came, they were seen through a real duality as, you know, authentic Jews sort of walking out of the Bible. But also they were discriminated against as poor people of color who would need, you know, a lot of help from the state. I like to look at the story through the lens of henna because I think it gives us a really interesting perspective. When the Yemenite Jewish women came over in the early 50s, they stopped doing henna because they wanted to assimilate. And henna was seen as, you know, primitive and backwards. So they really stopped doing henna. But the granddaughters of those women who came over rediscovered their grandmother's henna traditions. And today, if you are at a Yemenite wedding in Israel, in all likelihood, you'll be treated to a night of henna. And I think that really speaks to how today, you know, the Yemenite Jews in Israel are fully integrated and appreciated segment of society.
Being Jewish, of course, is about a culture and it's about a religion. And I wonder if you thought about how much expression of faith and how much thinking about sort of the tenets of Judaism would be in this book as opposed to simply the experience of living within a Jewish culture.
Well, it's certainly hard to separate. When you see photographs, there are these incredible, iconic photographs of the Yemenite Jews walking down through the mountains. They've left their homes because of political oppression and drought and instability. And they're walking to Aden, where they hope they'll be rescued. And in all those pictures, there's family groupings, and there'll be like two men and maybe three women and a whole bunch of kids. And one of the men is always carrying a Torah. And I can just imagine if somebody, you know, told me you have to leave your home tomorrow, what are you going to take with you? And this certainly resonates in terms of what's going on today with the refugee crisis. You know, what would you take with you? And the fact that in all those pictures, you know, one man has have his hands free for the holy book. Well, I think that just speaks to how important religion, the holy book, the Torah, was in the lives of the Jews of Yemen. And it certainly was important to my storytelling.
Yeah, and it's an element in this story that it's always carried like an infant.
Yes.
It's like somebody's job is just to carry that.
Yeah. It has to be cradled.
Even though no one can read it.
They can read the Torah. The men can read the Torah.
The men can read it. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how do you know when you have finished a book and you can move away from it? Because it is so clear you finished writing this book several years ago. You are still very much in love with these characters. So how do you unlatch from them to focus on the next thing?
Well, I'll always be in love with them. They'll always be a part of me. But at a certain point in your writing, there's this self-evidence. The ending sort of announces itself to you, and you realize that it's time to move on. You've given these characters the space they needed to breathe. But they're always inside of you. We writers are packed full of people. And we try and just keep hold of them all.
It's challenging based on when Adela lives that we know that even at the point that she finds her way to some kind of independence and some kind of a happy life, there are very dark times ahead for Jews in history in the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah, that was important for me this book does take place in part during the 1940s, and the events of the Holocaust intrude upon Adela's life. And, it's very difficult chapters, but it was important for me to include them here.
So going back to you as a child reader, were there particular authors that you were drawn to?
Oh, well, I grew up reading Nancy Drews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I had a whole closet full, and nothing was better on a winter day than just to pick another one out and spend some time with Nancy in her white gloves.
That cool car and all that independence from her father. Yeah,
that roadster, and he always let her just go.
Yeah.
So I started with Nancy Drew, and, I grew up with Little Women, and I graduated onto, Jane Austen and the Brontes, and I still go back to those books. I reread, Jane Austen every year for sure, and Wuthering Heights, all the time. Women writers, but also, as I said, I was a very eclectic reader. So Robert Ludlum and I don't know, I could go on and on.
All over the map.
Yes.
Do you feel at all like when you're writing that are there not coded messages, but are there things in here that you think I want my children to read this someday and take? Because there is an aspect of yourself in this writing, even if the characters have nothing to do with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my first book has a lot of sex in it, so my kids are never allowed to read that book ever.
Maybe after they deliver a grandchild.
Maybe. Yeah. But this book, my 13-year-old has already read this book. She's my voracious reader, and she's already read it. And that meant a lot to me that she read it, and she loved Adela. And it was really great for me to be able to share Adela with her.
Do you think in pictures when you're writing?
Yes, yes. You put your finger on it. I write from word pictures. I see like a scene in my head. It's like a photo still of a certain image that I know is going to happen to my characters. And I have to make that image real, that picture real. It's literally like a snapshot in my head of something that I know is going to happen to these characters.
So tonight when you're speaking, do you actually give a speech or do you answer questions? What's going to happen?
Tonight I will be talking about my book. I'll be what I like to do is I like to answer the questions people always have for me. People want to know why I wrote this book. People want to know how I did my research, my life is like as a writer. So I speak a whole bunch about that. And then I show photographs of the world of my characters. So I have some historic photographs that I share and I take questions.
Nomi Eve is the author of The Family Orchard and Henna House. Henna House is the book selection for this year's Jewish Federation of Greater Dallas Community Read event. Happens this evening at 7 at the Aaron Family JCC in Dallas. Nomi, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I had a blast.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.